case this afternoon is JV Properties LLC versus SMR 7 LLC, number 62035. If you're ready to proceed for appellants, Mr. Vlasic.
Thank you, Justices. Good afternoon. Charles Vlasic and Scott Bogatz with me from Bogatz Law Group on behalf of the appellant JV Properties LLC. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for my rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the court. We're here today because we believe the district court erred in three fundamental ways in determining the underlying case. First, we believe the district court properly applied NRS 111.170. We believe the district court improperly applied the merger by deed doctrine, and we believe that the district court improperly awarded damages to the respondent SMR 7. A few background facts just so the court is aware of the dispute and the nature of the dispute that brought the parties before the court today. The dispute relates to the sale of three parcels of real property. Each parcel was encumbered by an $11 million deed of trust. It was approximately $11 million, and the deed of trust encumbered not just these three subject parcels, but also an additional 27 other parcels. The parties to the agreement, seller, which was the appellant, JV Properties, and the respondent, SMR 7, executed, first negotiated, then executed detail offer and acceptance agreements with respect to the purchase and sale of the three parcels of property. The agreements were nearly identical in that they had paragraph after paragraph of hand-typed provisions in the document, not just boilerplate language, but actually negotiated for contractual provisions that specified the parties' obligations, rights, duties, and most importantly, that specified what would happen in the event there was a problem with the sale of the property. Unfortunately, there was a problem with the sale of at least one of the parcels of property. That's the parcel we're here today to talk about, in that the $11 million deed of trust on that particular parcel was not released, but the $11 million deed of trust was released on the other two parcels. In the subsequent
who released that? The beneficiary of the deed of trust, was it reconveyed or what?
It was reconveyed by way of escrow instructions from the title insurance company.
At the time of the sale.
The preliminary title reports, which I believe in the record, show that the title company picked up the deed of trust on two of the parcels, but for whatever reason, it looks like it was an oversight on the title company's part, did not pick up the deed of trust on the third property, which is the subject of this lawsuit.
So was the beneficiary ever requested to release the deed of trust on the parcel that's in dispute today?
Some years down the road, but not at that time.
Okay.
That was handled through escrow. Unfortunately, as I stated, there was a problem that the deed of trust was not released, and in the lawsuit that followed, the district court found that first, the appellant JV Properties violated NRS 111.170 in not having that deed of trust released from the subject parcel. The district court also found that the appellant JV Properties could not use the purchase agreements to limit their liability or prohibit the respondent SMR 7 from seeking damages under the offer and acceptance agreements. And finally, the district court awarded the respondent SMR 7 enough damages to effectuate the release of the deed of trust with interest. That's what happened in the lower court. The reason we're here today is because we believe the district court erred first in finding or in applying NRS 111.170. That statute, NRS 111.170, provides that unless otherwise expressly restrained in the deed, the grantor who grants by way of grant bargain sale deed is expressly covenanting that the property is free from prior encumbrances and also that the property has not been previously conveyed and no interest in that property has been previously conveyed. The district court and the respondent both focus solely on those two covenants contained within NRS 111.170, the two covenants that deal with prior encumbrances and prior alienation. What the district court and the respondent ignore is the first part of that statute, which states that unless expressly restrained by the terms contained in that deed. In this case, We can see that the deed expressly restrained the covenants that were being given to the seller. The deed of trust expressly provided that the property was being granted subject to taxes on the property that were due for fiscal year 2006 and 7, and more importantly, that the property was being deeded subject to rights that were recorded on the property as of the date of the sale. There's no dispute in this case that the $11 million deed of trust was recorded against the property and was validly recorded as of the date of the sale. The only dispute that the parties have and that the respondents will need to come up here and explain to this court is how a deed of trust is not a right under NRS 111, I'm sorry, under the grant bargain sale deed.
Well, isn't the question rather, isn't a deed of trust an encumbrance which is expressly covered under 1B? I mean, why would we try to evaluate this from the standpoint of language used in 1A when it is seems to be expressly covered in 1B, and if we say that right, or actually the word is rights, encompasses encumbrances, then what would be the point of B?
I believe, Your Honor, we're actually looking at the terms contained in Section 1, not A or B, but the first part of the statute that says, unless restrained by express terms contained in such conveyances, these default covenants run to the seller. So I'm looking at the first part of the statute that says that you can contract around, or in the grant bargain sale deed, around these two conveyances. Mm-hmm. So in this case, the deed of trust that can be found in the record at Joint Appendix 155 through 157, it's Volume 1, states that the property is being transferred subject to reservations, restrictions, conditions, rights of way, and easements, if any, on record on said premises. So what I'm looking at, and what I think the legislature intended, is that these two default covenants, A and B, under 111 and 170, can be restrained by the grant bargain sale deed. I think they were in this case. And the reason I think they were is the court can look at dictionary to define the meaning of a term, if it's so inclined. This case, Black's Law Dictionary, expressly states that a right is an interest created in property. That's what a deed of trust is. It's a right created in the deed of property right. Also, it's well settled that when words in a statute have a well-defined meaning at common law, court can and should interpret.
I'm confused about this, and I didn't follow your explanation a moment ago. 111, 170, 1 refers to unless restrained by express terms contained in such conveyances, and then goes on to say in A, that previous to the time of the execution of the conveyance of the grantor has not conveyed the same real property or any right. And you want us to focus on the word right. And then B, and then it talks about free from encumbrances. Why would we interpret the word right to incorporate encumbrances when B expressly refers to encumbrances? I don't see anything in the previous introductory language in 1 that forces the court to distinguish or to treat right as something that is separate from encumbrance. I didn't follow your explanation earlier. Could you
give it another
go if you don't mind?
Try it again, just as hard to see. NRS 111-170 starts off with when you have a grant bargain sale deed, mm-hmm. you're making some covenants to the seller of that mm-hmm. property. You're promising, unless you state otherwise, that 1A and 1B are your promises.
Okay, let's start with that point. Unless you state otherwise, in what?
In the conveyance.
In the deed itself, right?
Correct.
Okay.
In this case, in the deed, the property said it was being conveyed subject to rights that are on record, recorded against that property as of the date of the sale. The deed of trust was a right recorded against that property as of the date of the sale. So what I'm saying, it's our position that the provisions of A and B have been restrained by the express terms of the deed. And I'm getting there by looking at the common law usage of the word right and deed of trust. A deed of trust is a right in property. And I think the dictionary supports that. And I think the common law usage, the understanding of what the commonly understood usage of a deed of trust, it's a right in property. So I believe the deed of trust restrained, I'm sorry, the grant bargain sale deed in this case restrained the provisions of A and B under NRS 111.170. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yes, it answers my question. I understand your argument.
Thank you. I'll move on to our second. I think that's our first position. Mm-hmm. Our second issue here is that we believe the district court improperly applied the merger by deed doctrine. The merger by deed doctrine is a common law doctrine that states generally when you execute and deliver a deed, the underlying contract that dealt with the sale of the property is merged into and is subsumed by that deed. Now, this court in Hanneman versus Downer specifically said before a court applies the common law merger by deed doctrine, it needs to make sure that it's considered all the exceptions to that rule. Most importantly, the court said it will not allow a party to resort to the merger by deed doctrine if that party is intending or attempting to somehow skirt the obligations contained in the underlying purchase agreement. That's exactly what's going on here. The parties expressly agreed what would happen in connection with the sale of this property. The seller was to obtain title insurance, was to obtain a title abstract and identify in writing what it didn't like in the title or recorded against the property. Whatever it didn't like, the seller was to remove. If it did not provide that in writing, its objections, it forever waived its right to come after the seller for any problems that might arise as a result of an unclear title.
Didn't the offer and acceptance agreements provide that the property was being sold free of the encumbrance of the $11 million deed of trust?
No, Your Honor, Justice Hardesty, I don't believe it did. In fact,
well, then why would there have been requests for reconveyance of the other two parcels?
I'm not saying, Your Honor, that wasn't maybe part of the intention of the parties. What I'm saying is that specific risk, the risk of if there's something wrong with title to this property, the risk will be the risk and the remedy would be to seek recovery from the title insurance company. That's the bargain that the parties had.
But don't you agree that perhaps not expressly but certainly implied from the agreement, the buyer didn't buy this property with the intent to have an $11 million lien on it?
That's fair, Your Honor. I can't sit here and...
And so my question is this. It seems like your merger argument raises an inconsistency with regard to your first argument, because to the extent that the court would agree that there isn't merger and that the liability is confined to title policy coverage, wouldn't we also have to take that into consideration in addressing whether the encumbrance was addressed specifically in the deed?
That might be, Your Honor. You raised some valid points, and I think what happened in this case is there was no discovery, and this case was decided very quickly on summary judgment. Mm-hmm. In the Hanneman versus Downer case, this court specifically said that whether the documents themselves intend for the parties to have the purchase agreement merge into the deed and whether or not the parties themselves intended for that, documents and the parties' intent, they're questions of fact to be decided by the trier of fact. In this case, we didn't get that opportunity. At the very minimum, that's part of our brief. there's a genuine issue of material fact in dispute as to what the deal really was and what the parties really intended and what the documents really say. We believe it's clear that the merger by deed doctrine should not be applied, but at the very least, there's genuine issues of material fact as to that issue. And
what is the material question of fact on this issue about the title policy answering for any damage claims?
I don't know that that specifically is the issue of fact. I think the issue of fact here is whether the parties contracted as a shipper would, as a seller of goods would, when it puts its goods with a shipper. If there's a loss in connection with that shipment, may I proceed, Your Honor?
Sure.
If there's a loss in connection with the shipment of the goods, once the seller places them with the shipper, the risk of loss is to be borne by the insurance company. That's exactly what happened here. The parties agreed expressly, and not in boilerplate language typed on the back of some form document, but they expressly stated, look, there's some issues here. You need to get title insurance. You need to take a look at the title insurance. If you don't like something you see, then you deal with it through title insurance if you don't raise that issue.
I think we understand your argument, Mr. Vlasic. You exhausted your time. I interrupted you, so we'll add 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Unless my colleagues have questions, I'll invite counsel for respondent to make his arguments, okay? And he'll have 18 minutes. Of course, one doesn't always have to use them, but...
Understood, Justice Hardesty.
But if you get them, maybe you should. I don't know.
Aaron Morris on behalf of Respondent SMR7. This was among the simplest lawsuits I've ever dealt with in terms of real property transactions. We identified 8 undisputed facts. I don't believe any issue has been raised by the respondents either at this level or at the district court level that any of those 8 undisputed facts were in fact in dispute. We identified one statute, NRS 111.170, which was adopted by the Nevada legislature in 1861. I've been unable to find any information leading me to believe that it's ever been amended. It basically establishes the covenants that flow with the use of a grant bargain sale deed, or for that matter, any deed that uses the words grant bargain sale. And we directed the court to the Henneman decision, where this court acknowledged the use of the merger by deed doctrine, which is the doctrine which basically makes it possible for people to buy and sell real property, to search records to real to title records, and to ensure titles to real property and loans secured by title to real property. I mean, think about it. If we didn't have the merger by deed doctrine, if a title insurer or prospective purchaser, before either issuing an insurance policy or making a loan or acquiring title to real property, if they couldn't rely on the public record, if they couldn't look at the vesting deeds to determine what rights, in fact, are held by the prospective grantor and what rights would be taken by the grantee, the position taken by the appellant in this case, basically that you should be able to do away with the vesting deed and look at the purchase agreement which led to the vesting deed, creates a situation whereby no party could ever determine what in fact they were potentially acquiring, potentially borrowing against, potentially insuring, unless not only did they have the vesting deed, but they had the purchase agreement, the escrow instructions, everything that led to the vesting deed. So it's kind of...
Well, actually, that's not, as you heard, not their first argument. And as I pointed out to counsel, it seems inconsistent to argue the merger doctrine on the one hand and focus on the effect of a 111-170 and then talk about the fact that we should examine the offer and sale and acceptance agreement in the context of the title coverage and liability. But that said, I'm not sure that I have heard an articulation of 111-170 quite the way counsel has expressed their argument. I'd like you to address that, if you would, please.
I'd be happy to. I do not agree with the appellant's view of NRS 111-170. My reading of that statute is that the plain language controls, that any time a person uses the words grant bargain sale in a deed conveying property, whether it's titled grant bargain sale deed or not, they are making 2 covenants. They don't have to be found in the actual vesting deed, but the simple fact is there are 2 covenants with that. One, that the person conveying title by way of that deed has title to that property and that they have not previously conveyed that or any rights to that property to anybody else. And then the second is that that property is being conveyed free and clear of all encumbrances. And then the NRS 170, 111, what is it, sub 2, makes it very clear that if a person conveys title using a deed that uses the words grant, bargain, and sale without having the ability to convey that property, in other words, not having all of the rights to that property, or if the property is encumbered, the party who takes title to that can sue upon those covenants as if they were specifically laid out in the deed. It's a plain language reading. I don't think I'm supplying the court with anything, any nuance there. The reality is in this situation that the evidence presented, I heard Mr. Vlasic point out the fact that this case was decided on summary.
But his argument is that in dressing the word right as used in 1A, we should encompass or include within that definition the word encumbrance. When I used to practice in this area, was thinking about all the deeds that I'd seen, and I'm pretty familiar with, and I think it's common fare that the deed says, you know, I convey free and clear, and that it's subject to recorded, you know, easements and encumbrances, or not encumbrances, but easements and title and interest and so forth. But I never really understood right to include encumbrance. Does right mean instead like a joint tenancy right, I mean a tenant in common right, or a...
What you're talking about, what rights applies to in this instance would be easements. In other words, the right of use to a third party. In other words, that you're conveying title to somebody. This would be NRS 111, 170, 1A. Mm-hmm. If you were conveying title to somebody using a grant, bargain, sale deed without disclosing to them that there was an easement which provided a third party with a right of use or dominion and control over that property. And you were exactly right when you pointed out to Mr. Vlasic that you really can't, it's a difficult argument for him to make, you really can't say rights is synonymous with encumbrances because it would completely destroy NRS 111, 170 because sub 1A uses rights and sub 1B uses encumbrances. The legislature specifically created different subsections for rights and encumbrances. So the argument that the appellant's advancing that rights are synonymous with encumbrances, it's belied by the statute.
But he uses an ordinary meaning of the word referring to the dictionary and says rights encompasses encumbrances. What do you say to that?
Disagree with his reliance in this instance on a plain language approach. In other words, point out a Webster's dictionary to determine whether the word right is somehow found in the definition of deed of trust. Here, I think the statute makes it pretty clear that rights are not equal to encumbrances and encumbrances are not equal to rights. Otherwise, you wouldn't need a 1A and a 1B. You would just have a section which said rights and encumbrances or rights including encumbrances. And the language of the actual vesting deed, this is the language that I'm sure you saw in your practice in almost every grant, bargain, sale deed you ever saw. It says subject to reservations, restrictions, conditions, rights of way, and easements, if any, of record on said premises. If you're going to use a deed and somebody is going to take the property subject to an encumbrance, this would be the place where you would lay it out. Subject to that deed of trust recorded on this date in this book as this instrument number, and you would identify the grantor and the grantee to make sure that the world was on notice, constructive notice of the existence of that encumbrance and the fact that the property was being taken subject to that encumbrance. To just say, because you had the catch-all rights reservations language, and to try to say that that somehow meant that my client was taking title to a piece of property they were buying for, you know, under $600,000 and it's going to be subject to a $10.8 million deed of trust, that's a bit of a stretch.
It seems to me that he's making an argument that your client was placed on some kind of notice.
I did not hear that argument.
Subtly there, because he's saying there's an encumbrance sitting on that deed, as you were talking about, should have been, he's saying it's recorded, and you're saying there was no reference to that, but...
Well, understand that my client tenders the purchase price of just under $600,000 and receives in return for that the the title to that property. My client does not know at that time whether that deed of trust is still of record on that property. It's not until the appellant stopped making payments on that deed of trust, it goes into foreclosure, and my client learns that his property is subject to foreclosure based on JV Property's previously existing deed of trust. The escrow instructions in this case, and it's actually the other side which likes to focus on the escrow instructions, made it pretty clear that that wasn't going to happen, and this that wasn't supposed to happen. And this is the appendix JA-136. It identifies the specific exceptions that were to be included in the deed, and it provides four. And specifically, with regard to, I'll read the last two. Number three provides covenants, conditions, restrictions, reservations, rights of way, and easements now of record, if any, affecting the use and occupancy of said property, as the same may now appear of record, except as otherwise specifically required herein. And then D, the section four is, deeds of trust to record through this escrow to secure buyer's new financing, if any. This is where, if in fact Mr. Vlasic's argument had any legs, you would see a provision that referenced this deed of trust, it being taken, the vesting deed should have reference subject to that. That didn't occur. And I need to point out that one of the nice things about this case, we can find our motion very simply to the 015 parcel, and we pointed, you know, one statute, one case, eight facts, we win. That was kind of our argument. The response that came back in opposition, the first thing it did was it pointed out the fact that there were three parcels that were put under contract the exact same day. They used identical purchase agreements, identical escrow instructions, identical vesting deeds, and they were all subject to the exact same $10.8 million deed of trust. The reality is, the deeds of trust, that deed of trust was released from two of those three parcels. So for this court to accept the appellant's argument in this case, it basically would have to conclude that the meaning of the terms in the vesting deed used with respect to the 015 parcel had some kind of different meaning than the vesting deeds used on the other two transactions, or that the meaning of the terms in the escrow instructions with regard to the 015 parcel had some kind of different meaning than it did with respect to the other two parcels. The reality in this case was, when we showed up in front of the district court judge on this motion for summary judgment, you can read, if you read the transcript, you can see she recognized this case was relatively new. I mean, some discovery had gone on, but basically she was looking at this, trying to find any reason to deny my client's motion for summary judgment. And the reality that the court was faced with was the arguments that were being advanced by appellant's counsel in this case, although they might sound like they had some merit, they were unable to provide any evidence.
Well, let me shift your attention to the other issue where perhaps summary judgment was early. Counsel argues that the merger doctrine as between the agreement and the deed shouldn't extend to the damage award in this case because of the agreement's provision regarding corresponding title company's coverage. Was the district court premature in its decision in awarding monetary damages without considering the effect or impact of the cross-title policy coverages?
No, I think the district court was aware of the existence of title insurance. That issue had been raised from day one by appellant's counsel. The simple fact was that the court was presented with a payoff demand, and we walked through this in the briefing, that my client, as the owner of the property, was authorized by law to request a payoff demand from the current beneficiary of the deed of trust. My client did so. A payoff demand was then provided by the beneficiary based on the release price. They used the exact same release price that had been used for the other two parcels that were reconveyed that exact same day that the transaction closed for my client. And that, pursuant to Nevada law, my client was entitled to rely upon that payoff demand, and that was the measure of damages that were awarded in this case. The argument we used, and it was more of a common sense argument in response to Mr. Vlasic's position about title insurance, was that just because a person may have another remedy, in other words, another source of funds to recover for their damages, doesn't mean that if you breach a contract with that person or you commit a tort, that you're not liable for those damages. We use the situation with an uninsured motorist coverage. You know, a person slams into me while I'm driving to court, causes me $1 million in pain and suffering. they cannot come to court and say, I'm excused from my negligence because this person had underinsured or uninsured motorist coverage to cover that damages. We don't dispute that there's a title policy out there. We don't dispute that there may be an avenue down the road for relief for my clients. But the first thing that they get under that title policy is a defense of their title. And under NRS 111-170, there's an absolute defense in this case because you have a breach of the covenant provided in the statute. I'd be happy to address any questions the court had. This really was a matter of a failure of proof. All the arguments that they, especially with regard to the merger doctrine, you have the quote in Hanneman where the Nevada Supreme Court says, this court says, this is an issue of fact. The intent of the parties is an issue of fact. Under Nevada law, you now have a material issue. The question is, do you have a genuine question? Is there a genuine issue of that material fact in this litigation? And the answer in this case was no. There was nothing provided by the appellants to give any indication that it was not the intention of these parties that the purchase agreement merge into the vesting deed. And there were basically four things that the court was able to look at. The grant bargain sale deed, there was nothing in there that indicated that the terms of the purchase agreement were to somehow survive the grant bargain sale deed. The escrow instructions, absolutely no reference in the escrow instructions that the terms of the purchase agreement were to supersede or survive the recording of the vesting deed. The purchase agreement itself, again, you have three purchase agreements. They're all identical. Nothing in there indicates that even following the recording of the vesting deed, the purchase agreement will still govern the relationship between the parties. And then the most important one was the fourth piece of evidence. There was a declaration provided by Mr. DeVore, who was a principal of JD Properties. And I have to give Mr. DeVore a great deal of credit in this one. He used the affidavit, he used his declaration to authenticate the documents that his attorneys needed to make the argument, but even he would not go so far as to say that it was the intention of the parties that the purchase agreement survive the recording of the vesting deed, and he also would not go so far as to say that there was any understanding that SMR7 would take title to this property subject to this $10.8 million deed of trust. You see a lot of things in declarations that cause you trouble. I was impressed by Mr. DeVore, the fact that he would not get out there and make these arguments, even though his counsel was kind of advancing that position in court. But really, that left the district court judge with nothing. I mean, is it a material fact? Yes. But was there a genuine issue with respect to that material fact? No. There was nothing that the district court judge had which would allow her to delay entry of summary judgment on this case. With that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Other than that, I would just request that the court affirm the district court's decision with respect to both liability and damages.
Do my colleagues have any questions for counsel? You realize, of course, that you don't get to use the 2 minutes saved in your next argument.
I understood, but I've also been taught that if you think you made a point, sit down and let it move on.
Okay, sounds good. Mr. Glassman.
First, I'd like to address NRS 111-170 and the arguments surrounding that statute. Counsel just stated that his reading was that that you can only look at in every time you have a grant bargain sale deed, you get these covenants that are provided for in section 111-170, 1 sub A and 1 sub B, and there's no way to get around those covenants. That can't be what the statute means. It doesn't say that. It says unless otherwise expressly restrained. He's reading that provision out of the statute, and as this court knows, you can't read words out of the statute. You need to use every word and apply every word that's in the statute. If the legislature did not intend to allow people to restrict the general default covenants that come along with a grant bargain sale deed, they wouldn't have had that provision in the statute.
Counsel, was your client responsible to put them on kind of an actual notice by referring to the encumbrance in the document?
Thank you, Justice Douglas. I don't know that my clients drafted, and I don't believe they did draft the grant bargain sale deed. I believe that was the escrow company.
Well, the question is, how would they have been put on notice if there was an encumbrance if it's not stated?
This deed of trust, this $11 million deed of trust, was recorded against the property.
But how would they know, looking at that, what was in front of them, that there was some encumbrance?
believe the parties agreed and bargained for the bargain they had was that they would look to the title company to obtain title insurance, and they would have an escrow company transact this deal for them.
But that's as to, based on what you're giving me, unforeseen situations. Unless they're pointed to something, they don't know it's out there.
I guess if you're trying to pin me down and get me to say that I think that our client should have somehow put the deed of trust in, or, I'm sorry, specifically referred to the $11 million deed of trust in the grant bargain sale deed, I don't think that was our client's job.
You told the court before that they were responsible for those things there. They made the argument that there should have been a specific reference, so I'm trying to draw out your position as to that issue.
I believe the word all rights of record recorded against the property is sufficient to put them on notice of any rights that might be recorded against that property, including the $11 million deed of trust or anything else that might be recorded against that property. There was an error here, that's for sure. There's no disputing that.
I hope you're not suggesting, that the parties entered into a transaction where respondents would pay your client $600,000 and take the property subject to an $11 million deed of trust. Who in their right mind would do that? And don't we have to conclude that that's what the contract provides in order to reach your position?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what the parties agreed to, I'm not representing that at all. I think what's clear from...
Isn't that the practical outcome, though, of your argument?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what the practical outcome is that the parties, like a lot of parties do, prior to this transaction, they sat down and they negotiated, hey, here are all the things that we need to do, both sides. We get to do, we need to do, we must do, and here are the things that will result or that will happen if there's a problem. You'll obtain title insurance. We didn't have to say that, but we said you'll obtain title insurance, and you'll let us know what on the title insurance policy or the abstracts you don't like. We'll remove those things. If there's any problem later, you look to your title insurance company. That's not our fault. That's your title insurance company's fault. Parties prospectively limit their damages.
Well, they might have a claim against their title policy, but the issue, as counsel points out in this case, is a breach of contract question. The title policy dispute is one for another day, isn't it?
Well, in that case, Your Honor, you might be correct. Again, this case was decided far before any breach of contract, I think.
Well, the title companies aren't even in this case.
That is an interesting fact, Your Honor.
It's a reality. So this is purely, at least insofar as the sitting district court judge is concerned, the people in front of her are the parties to this contract. So this is a straight-up breach of contract interpretation and statutory interpretation question, isn't it?
I believe it's a statutory interpretation question and a common law merger by deed question. I don't believe that it's clear from the grant bargain sale deed that the parties did not agree to transfer the property subject to the rights recorded against the property. I don't believe in Hanneman. Counsel said, look at the Hanneman case and look and see what would happen if there was no merger by deed doctrine. That's an excellent point. What would happen is what almost happened in Hanneman. The court did not apply the merger by deed doctrine. The court specifically said, we're not going to apply the merger by deed doctrine when one party is attempting to avoid her contractual obligations by resort to the merger by deed doctrine. It's not an absolute doctrine. And the reason it's not is because if it was, then any agreements the parties had, any agreements that revolved around the sale or the purchase of property would go away and would not exist after a grant bargain sale deed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lasik. I think you've exhausted your time, and I appreciate both counsel's arguments and your briefs to the court. We appreciate your input. Thank you. The case will stand submitted.